We'll hear argument first this morning in case 07499, Negussie versus Mukasey. Mr. Pincus.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. A father forced at gunpoint to engage in incest with his daughter because of his religion, race, or political views, and told that he and his daughter will be killed if he refuses, is far outside the class of persons brought to mind by the ordinary meaning of the phrase at issue in this case, which is reprinted on page 1 of our brief, quoting from Section A42, any person who ordered, incited, assisted, or otherwise participated in the persecution of any person on account of a prohibited factor. The same is true of someone who is part of the religious persecution directed against him, is forced on threat of death to disrupt a prayer meeting and injure his co-religionists. The father and the co-religionist are victims of persecution. They would not be described in ordinary parlance as persecutors. And we think that that really is dispositive of the question in this case. Under the government's view, the persecutor bar turns solely on what they term objective effect of an individual's acts. But that means that the act need not be accompanied by any of the indicia of moral offensiveness that the law typically requires. Even if the individual acted under duress, under threat of death, even if the individual did not know that his conduct related to persecution, and even if the individual had no
questions. We begin with the assumption that this is a Chevron deference case. And I think Aguirre, INS versus Aguirre, would tell us that it was a different statute. Do we begin with that assumption?
Well, I think under Chevron, step one, the first question is there a gap to be filled here? Is the language
ambiguous? Do I begin with Chevron?
Well, yes, we think Chevron supplies the framework. The first question is there ambiguity? We argue that here, if you — and our principal submission is that there is no ambiguity here, and that there's therefore no occasion for deference. If the Court were to disagree with that
— Your position is that there's no ambiguity in the way the term is used in the statute, as opposed to no ambiguity in some abstract sense.
Yes, our submission, Mr. Chief Justice, is that the phrase here, using the principle that the Court applied in Watson, looking at the phrase and looking at the picture that it brings to mind, would never bring to mind the examples that I cited as conduct that would be captured by this provision.
Mr. Pincus, could I ask about your description of the government's position as saying that it's purely objective and that there's no mental factor whatever? Is it clear that the government not only would not take into account coercion, the fact that it was done under coercion, but also would not take into account the fact that the individual even knew?
There are cases
that he was persecuting somebody?
Yes, Your Honor, there are cases, some of which that determination has been reversed by a court of appeals, but the BIA has taken the position for —
Has the government taken that position here, in this case?
We've pointed out that is the position that the BIA has taken, and the government has not disavowed it. So I don't know whether they're taking
it. I guess I should ask the government.
Yes, Your Honor. But there certainly have been a number of decisions along that line, including one, for example, where an individual was told, you know, stand here, don't on the other side of the hill.
Well, I could think that that's wrong without thinking that you also have to take into account whether there was coercion.
You could, Your Honor, although the government's underlying theory for all three of its positions, both that coercion doesn't matter, that knowledge doesn't matter, and that subjective intent doesn't matter, is its view that these words require only objective acts. Once you determine that the words require something more,
it's very common in criminal statutes to require knowledge of the act. Indeed, if the person doesn't know what he's doing, he may be insane, but he's not a criminal. Whereas it is not automatically clear that the fact that you killed somebody because otherwise they'd break your arm would be a justification. I mean, it seems to me the two are quite separable.
Well, two responses, Your Honor. Certainly in the criminal context, duress is a well-recognized defense, and this Court has said that in Dixon and other cases. But I just want to be clear that the knowledge that we're talking about here that the government has disavowed is not knowledge that you've engaged in an act. They don't take the position that sleepwalking is can be a persecutive act. But their view is even if you don't know that your act is contributing to persecution, you're kept in the dark by the actual persecutors. They've just asked you to do something that in fact is contributing to persecution. They say that doesn't matter. And that all rests on what we think is their wrongheaded construction of the statute. I just want to
Your position is that any threat of serious injury is sufficient.
Excuse me?
Your position is that any threat of serious injury is sufficient.
No, Your Honor. I mean, obviously, the
No, that's
the court,
what your brief says.
Well,
being forced upon threat of death or serious injury to participate in the persecutory acts of his oppressors.
Yes, and our position is that that's a logical starting point. There is, of course, a body of law that's been developed in the criminal context about the parameters of the defense of duress, and that would be a very pretty logical starting point, we think. The Attorney General would have discretion once the court corrected the view that the statute doesn't that coercion is irrelevant to within the limits of Chevron define what the coercion test is.
Well, if someone said, if you don't, there are 500 men, women, and children in a shed. If you don't administer lethal gas to them, we're going to administer 20 lashes. That would be sufficient in your view?
Well, under some conceptions of this defense, there's a balancing test that between the threat that's directed against the individual and the threat and the injury that he's asked to carry out. That could be part of the test, as I say.
Well, that's not very helpful. How would the balancing be struck? How would you strike it there?
Well, what the courts have said in the criminal context is that there are three criteria: an immediate threat of death or serious bodily injury, a well-grounded fear that will be carried out, and no reasonable opportunity to escape. That's the general standard. So in the criminal context,
you wouldn't balance. I mean, say, you know, gas these 20,000 people or we'll kill you.
It might be appropriate.
You gas the 20,000 people, right? And that's okay.
Well, some courts have said that murder is a different kettle of fish, and that there's a question unanswered in the federal system about whether or not there is a duress defense for murder. The states are divided. The model penal code has said, yes, there should be. That's one of the issues that would be open for the Attorney General to the extent he wishes to exercise his discretion to decide. What's clear, though, is, we think, the current construction of the statute is not right. There is a body of law out there that is well developed in the criminal context that could be a very logical starting point.
Why should the starting point be what this court decided in the Fedorenko case? I mean, the wording of this provision is very close to the wording of that statute, much closer than the UN covenant that you have referred to?
Well, Your Honor, two responses to that. First of all, the language in Fedorenko, the text was very context specific, and it shows that. The language that applied there specifically referred to the enemy and specifically referred to persecution of civilians, making quite clear that that was a statute that was targeted in the specific World War II context, which was all that it applied to.
There was also the distinction about the use of the word voluntary, in which the operative language which barred those people didn't have voluntary in it, and I forget what it was at the next textual section, it was there. So there was a reason to infer that voluntary activity was not a criterion for the bar. Isn't
exactly, Your Honor. And the court said the deliberate omission, it specifically looked at the fact that these sections were adopted at the same time, followed on each other immediately, and one had voluntary and didn't. And it said this was a deliberate omission, and we conclude that deliberate omission provides a basis for interpreting the language of the DPA.
Do you take the position that the government is wrong in saying that it's bound by Fedorenko, and that's a reason perhaps for us to send it back?
Exactly, Your Honor. I was going to get to the second part of, of your Chevron question and respond just that. If the Court were to conclude, contrary to our submission, that the language here is ambiguous and there's a gap to fill, our position is, and we think it's quite well borne out by the decisions, that the BIA's decisions here rested on the mistaken assumption that Fedorenko bound it in this case.
And do we begin with the decision of Rodriguez-Mahano?
But there are two that are relevant.
The BIA decision,
yes,
cited Fedorenko.
Rodriguez-Mahano is the first one. The issue was not even raised in that case. It was dicta. In the paragraph before citing Fedorenko, in fact, the BIA says the service agreed at oral argument that the actions don't constitute participation in persecution. So there really wasn't an issue there. But all that's there is a sentence and a reliance on Fedorenko. Seems pretty clear that that decision just mistakenly believe Fedorenko controlled
well,
the case.
Well, to give the devil his due, it's not just the BIA that took that view. It's every court of appeals that that has looked at this provision has said that Fedorenko is a guide to what it means, right?
Yes.
So you're faulting the BIA for you're saying it's beyond reasonable interpretation for the BIA to adopt the resolution of the ambiguity, assuming there's an ambiguity. Which comports with what every court of appeals to address the matter has said.
I think there are two different questions here, Justice Scalia. If the BIA purported to — if the BIA said there's a gap to fill here, we're going to exercise our expertise and discretion and decide that, that would be one situation. We think it's quite clear here that the BIA believed erroneously that Fedorenko compelled the result, that it thought that this was a Chevron Step 1 case, and it was merely reciting what it believed to be the rule and saying Fedorenko controls. So we
why do you think that's clear? What's the text you rely on?
The text that we're relying on is the actual decision, which just makes a flat statement. Again, in dicta, the participation, or I'm reading from Rodriguez-Mahano.
Do I have it in front of me?
You don't. It's a decision of the BIA.
Well, gee, if this is central to your case, don't you think I ought to have the language in front of me somewhere?
Well, actually, the language is on page 27 of our yellow brief. I apologize, Your Honor.
Wonderful.
At the very top of the page. So all that there is there is a recitation of the rule and a citation to Fedorenko, and our submission.
It's a C citation, right?
Yes.
Well, I mean, you know, it's just not a flat citation, which would say that governs. It means this is a relevant case that you should look to. And you don't deny that it's relevant. You try to distinguish it, but it's certainly something you should consider, no?
Well, Your Honor,
and that's all you have to say that they based it on Fedorenko.
Yes. Well, first of all, as I say,
the
statement in this decision is dictum. Here, I'm not sure whether they consulted the Blue Book before they picked the C site, but it seems to me that all we have here is a legal rule, and a legal rule that generally has been perceived to be the rule that was announced by Fedorenko, not tied in any way to the different statutory language at issue in this case or anything else. Let me also turn to the second decision that's relied on, which is the decision in this case. And there, and I'm looking at page 6A of the petition, the BIA says, citing to its prior decision in matter of Fedorenko, it recites this rule. Now, matter of —
C-site again, isn't it?
It's another C-site.
C? All right, okay, good.
This may indicate, because they're actually directly — well, anyway. Matter of Fedorenko, that's a case, and I apologize. In our brief, we said that was a case that relied on the DPA. That's actually a case that involved the Holtzman Amendment. Again, not the statute at issue in this case. And therefore, just sort of reflexively taking a rule in a different case and applying it to this very different statute without any analysis. And not to get into too much of a train of BIA logic, but I think it's important. The second case cited here, matter of Lipinics, which is actually the the precedent that Matter of Fedorenko relies on, again, specifically calls out Fedorenko and says, as in Fedorenko, and I'm quoting from page 464 of that decision, as in Fedorenko, the plain language mandates the result. So here, in all of the BIA analysis, there is no analysis in terms of exercising expertise and discretion.
I'm sorry, where the plain language dictates the result is where do I see that?
It's in a different BIA decision. It's in the Matter of Lapinkas decision at page 464.
You say citing Matter of Lapinkas?
Lapinkas, yes.
Citing, it says citing Matter of Lapinkas. Do you know if they cited it just flatly or was it a C-cite?
That I don't know, Your Honor.
You want to bet?
I'm betting on C.
If they say that the plain language of the statute dictates a particular result, I suspect that that's a concession we're in Chevron step one rather than two.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's why my response to Justice Kennedy's question is that if the Court were to disagree with us and conclude, contrary to our submission, that the language is ambiguous, then we don't have an exercise of agency discretion under Chevron Step 2 because all the agency decisions rest on the belief that the statutory language forecloses that exercise of that discretion. So in that event, we submit the appropriate result would be to remand the case. But of course,
Mr. Pincus, could you tell what's the consequence of this? I mean, if indeed your client is denied asylum because he participated in under coercion or not, discriminatory action against others, what is the consequence? Is he's not sent back to the country that is persecuting him, is he?
Well, his deportation has been deferred under the Convention Against Torture, so he has some protection, not the full protections that he would be entitled to if he were found to be a refugee.
What happens to him? Does he stay here? Or?
He gets to stay here.
Until some other country other than the one that will persecute him will receive him. Is that it?
Yes. Or if he were, he gets to stay here as long as sending him back would not involve torture. So the protection is narrower than the protection that generally would be available in two senses. First of all, it only applies to torture. If you were sent back and you were going to be imprisoned for life for the acts that are protected,
oh, really?
CAT would not protect you. And CAT also does not protect you against non-state action. So especially in the world today, where a lot of the bad things that happen in other countries are by rebels and non-state actors, the Convention Against Torture would not provide protection in that situation. So it's broader protection for a somewhat broader group of people.
Okay.
Well,
let me ask you about another practical consequence of your position. I've seen a lot of these asylum cases, and usually the evidence consists almost entirely of the uncorroborated statement made by the person who's claiming asylum. So in your view, the immigration judges are going to have to decide the degree of the threat that the asylum claimant underwent and the consequences of failing to comply with whatever he was directed to do. And they're going to have to do that based solely on a credibility determination made about an uncorroborated witness who's typically testifying through an interpreter and who has all of the mannerisms and aspects of speech of someone who comes from an entirely different culture. That's the consequences of the position that you're advocating.
Yes, Your Honor, just as in the initial question about whether someone has been subject to persecution in the first place, that is the process that we have. And immigration judges are quite skilled in getting to the bottom of what's going on. They also have, in addition, and as relied on in
this
case.
You really think that's true? They're quite skilled at getting to the bottom of making
well,
of these.
I think it is their job. I think they also have the country reports that the State Department prepares, and they were relied on in this case. If, for example, someone were to come in and say, I'm the victim of coercion, and the country report does not provide any indication that that's happening in the country, that's obviously a reason to look quite skeptically
no, well, if they
on
claim,
the claim.
I would be subject to persecution in Denmark if I were sent there. That might be an easy question, but they typically come from a country where there is persecution. And they could easily have been subjected to it, or they could also just as easily have read about it or heard about it in along their way here.
Yes,
you think
Your Honor,
that's
but
an easy determination.
Well, but it's true of the initial claim of persecution. If a refugee, an asylum applicant, comes and says, I've been subject to persecution and there's no issue of coercion in the case, that the concern that you've identified arises there.
Yes, but
the case-specific decision has to be made. This is an additional question that will have to be answered.
You're putting unprovable question upon unprovable question. I mean, to say that one question is really, really hard to figure out is no justification for laying on another one.
And we also think it's significant in this respect that the Secretary of Homeland Security has, in connection with a different disability, the material support disability, said that promulgated an exclusion for, in some circumstances, for people who are coerced to provide material support.
I'm curious, why did you answer Justice Alito's question yes? I would have thought that if you win this case, the Attorney General would still have a tremendous leeway in deciding where, when, under what circumstances the duress defense applied. Why isn't that so?
That's absolutely right, Justice Breyer.
Well, if that's right, then why do you not — why was your answer yes?
My answer was in the absence of action by the Attorney General. But I think you're absolutely right that the important thing to point out here is, as with the standard itself, the Attorney General could, in the asylum context, decide that in certain kinds of situations that this
Mr.
coercion is not relevant.
Refresh my recollection about something about the Fedorenko case, which I should have reread, but I honestly didn't in detail. Am I not correct that the point that Justice Alito makes was really part of the background of the case there was that nobody really believed his testimony? That it was assumed for purpose of decision that he was telling the truth, but it was pretty clear he was not. Whereas here, everybody does assume for purpose of decision that this man is telling the truth.
Yes, I think that's correct, Justice Stevens. And part of what was going on there was the just sheer — two things. The sheer administrative burden of millions of refugees and the need to process them in some kind of expeditious fashion, and the fact that it was known that there was a sort of an organized effort by people who had been participating, especially in the concentration camps, to come up with this defense.
Mr. Pincus, I didn't get the bottom line of your exchange with Justice Breyer. Is it your position that there has to be some coercion defense, but it's up to the Attorney General to say what it is? He could say only if you were threatened with death.
Yes.
Only if you were threatened with torture, not if it was threatened that your family would be exterminated. Where do you get that discretion in the statute?
Well, the Attorney General has rulemaking authority in the asylum area, certainly, and we think even with respect
any to old coercion defense he can just make, so long as there's some coercion defense, that's all you want. Some coercion defense.
Well, we think the question now before the court is there no coercion defense? That's the government's position. Flatly, totally irrelevant.
But why does the Attorney General have expertise in that area? I can understand why he has expertise when he knows that from experience that certain defenses are harder to prove than others, that certain evidence is harder to obtain than other evidence. But does the Attorney General really have expertise in determining degrees of duress, degrees of culpability? Is that within the Chevron framework?
Well, it seems to me it could well. I mean, obviously, that would be a question that would come up. But given that
why you concede that.
Well, I think once there is a coercion defense, it would be fleshed out in the administrative process.
But you said you'll never get past step one of Chevron. You say that this statute is clear. You say it's not ambiguous.
Absolutely. So, well, we say it's
not
ambiguous.
I think it's pretty ambiguous if, there's some old coercion defense, but we don't really know what it is.
Well,
it seems to me if you're going to say step one is clear, there has to be some coercion defense that of a substantial nature that the Attorney General cannot fritter away.
We agree with that, Your Honor, and I apologize.
And what
I suggested to the contrary.
What would be the minimum? You say the statute is clear. It requires some culpability. How would you verbalize what is the lowest standard that the Attorney General could impose to read this statute, to infuse in it some element of culpability?
Because the statutory context here was to implement our treaty obligations, and the treaty obligations refer to criminal conduct, we think the logical starting point that you're asking about, Justice Ginsburg, would be the criminal law standards, which, as I say, are well developed in the federal system.
Serious bodily harm.
Yes, it's a three-part test of a threat of serious bodily harm, no reasonable, well-grounded fear that it will be carried out, and no reasonable way to avoid it. Unless the court has any further questions,
Mr. Pinkus.
I'll reverse my time.
Mr. Katsas.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. In categorical terms, the Immigration and Nationality Act provides that persons who assist or otherwise participate in persecution may not obtain certain immigration.
Well, you stopped in the part that interests me. Participated in persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, or membership in a particular group. When these people are forced to engage in persecution, it's not because of the victim's race, religion. It's because someone's got a gun at their head. So you ask them, well, why did you do that? Why did you, whip that person? They'll say, because they were going to kill me. They're not going to say, because I'm biased against his race or religion.
No, but the on account of phrase, Mr. Chief Justice, modifies the persecution. The persecution in this case was
well, well,
is
you,
directed
how do you know
at
that? Why can't it just as easily modify incited, participated in? And even if it's persecution, did they participate in the persecution on account of race, or did they participate, again, in the persecution on account of what the force exerted against them was?
I think grammatically, the immediately preceding noun is persecution. If the on account of phrase modified the assistance, Mr. Chief Justice, it seems to me that would prove far too much in that a prison guard who served voluntarily in order to get a paycheck wouldn't be within the bar because he wouldn't be assisting on account of.
Well, that just brings you back to what assistance mean. If you are normal statutory canon, you've got ordered, incited,
right.
Assisted. Assistance can be read in the same sense as ordered or incited with terms of an active, I don't know what it is, predisposition or desire, or it can be read in the manner you suggested, somebody who's just doing it for the paycheck. So if we read it in use some generous terms, then I think your response falls short.
I don't think so, Mr. Chief Justice, in that the question here is the availability of a duress defense. One can order persecution under duress just as one can assist in persecution under duress. Imagine, for instance, the camp commandant at Treblinka ordering the slaughter of thousands of innocent people. He could say, well, I'm doing that under duress because if I don't order persecution, someone up my chain of command will kill me, which is precisely what's wrong with petitioner's theory here is its unbounded nature.
Well, but that argument is at one extreme, where if this does apply as the way petitioners suggest, we assume the Attorney General can exercise his discretion and not afford relief. But on the other hand, it could go to some of the horrific examples that Mr. Pincus suggested, and in those circumstances, the Attorney General could exercise his discretion to afford relief.
The Attorney General does not have discretion with respect to withholding, and remember, the persecutor bar in the asylum statute is identical to the persecutor bar in the withholding statute. But in any event, as this Court said in cases like Finpathia, the fact that the text goes to an eligibility requirement is not a ground for the Court reading in limitations that aren't there on the theory that the Attorney General can address something case by case. That's because immigration is subject to the plenary control of Congress, and when Congress writes a rule and this Court converts it into a standard, it's shifting control over the immigration laws from Congress to the executive and ultimately to the courts. It seems to us that reasoning governs here. With respect to your question about hard hypotheticals, I don't dispute that there are sympathetic persecutors on Mr. Pincus' side of the case. But keep in mind what is at stake here. Persecution is not typically a grassroots phenomenon. It's a phenomenon typically ordered by governments or rebel groups aspiring to be governments. It's typically carried out through coercion. So if petitioners are correct, not only the prison guard in this case, who held a gun to keep people out in the sun until they died, not only would he have a colorable defense, but so too would every single guard at Treblinka.
And so too would, I gather, the person who is threatened with harm if he doesn't build the prison walls, right? He knows they're going to be used to persecute people and hold them in. I mean, you know, if you push extreme interpretations, they go either way. Does he persecute people on account of race?
Well,
we have a prison here. We're going to hold members of a particular racial group here, and we're going to force you to build the walls.
Mr. Chief Justice, you're absolutely correct that there will, of course, be hard cases about how broadly to draw the circle. But in Fedorenko, this Court instructed that the way to deal with that problem is not by reading in a voluntariness exception into a statute that simply doesn't contain it,
but
rather
your position is that it's unbounded. If the legislature passes a statute requiring a specific intent, scienter, concepts of personal responsibility, we don't say this is unbounded.
Of course, Justice Kennedy, Congress could pass a statute with whatever.
I'm saying in the general criminal law, we don't say, "Oh, this is unbounded. This is what courts are for. This is what adjudication is for."
To
establish and define what duress means, what scienter means, what degree of intent is culpable, what isn't.
That's
unbounded.
That's true in the context of criminal law, but think about why it's true, Justice Kennedy. It's true because Congress, when it passes criminal statutes, legislates against a background of hundreds of years of common law precedent in the criminal area, and this Court has said presumptively Congress legislates against that common law background, and that is the theory for, on some occasions, reading mens rea requirements and common law defenses like duress into criminal statutes.
Starting where Justice Kennedy left off, you said 100 years. It's the thousands of years. I mean, you could go back into the history of the human race.
Exactly.
And you will discover, of course, that your word, involuntary, is never something where the action is involuntary, that we praise or blame people. Rather, every action where we praise or blame people must be a voluntary action. The classic example is the wind blew my arm. Now, you're saying that if this person's arm was blown by the wind, that this statute prevents him having asylum in the United States or having, you know, withholding. How could one assume that involuntary actions are covered by this statute, are not covered?
Justice Breyer, the case,
yeah.
Two points. With respect to involuntary actions, this case doesn't present that question.
All right. And once you say that, then let's talk about intentional actions.
Okay.
And are you going to have intentional actions? Because praise or blame typically involves a voluntary action, an intentional action, and an action where there is a degree of freedom, which is to say that the choice is not too skewed. And we see that in the criminal law by a reading in to statutes that say nothing of the word intentional, and by the use of the duress defense. Now, what reason do we have for thinking that Congress didn't mean these words here in exactly that way, which traces back at least to Aristotle?
Because the thousand-year tradition that you correctly identify is a criminal law tradition.
No, Aristotle doesn't say criminal law. He says praise or blame.
Justice Breyer, this is a statute. It's a statute that allocates immigration benefits. Immigration law is a creature of statute. There's no background.
That's absolutely right.
Common
law. You think Congress intended that this absolute bar should apply where the person is in no sense blameworthy?
The question with respect to intentional conduct, the conduct at issue here, Justice Breyer, is knowing and intentional. So there's no question about
it. No, but the reasoning here, Mr. Katsas, it seems to me, implicates exactly what Justice Breyer brings up. We had a colloquy earlier on the extent of the reliance by the BIA for its general policy on Fedorenko, and what did a C-site mean, and so on. But in this particular case, going to page 6A or 7A, from which Mr. Pincus was earlier quoting, if you look on page 7A, the reason that Fedorenko is thought to be appropriate here is he, that is to say the petitioner here, has not demonstrated that his conduct is distinguishable from that of the alien in that case. The conduct of the alien in that case was identified as relevant by the voluntary-involuntary distinction. It was so identified because of the text of the statute. Voluntary was used in one place. It wasn't used in the place where the bar was set out. So that it seems to me that by the express reasoning in this case is governed by a rule that in effect says the distinction between voluntary and involuntary action is not a relevant distinction. So I don't think you can get by in this case without confronting just what Justice Breyer says. And I don't see how you can answer his point in this case without admitting that Fedorenko, in fact, was improvidently relied upon because it's not good authority here.
I don't know why with respect to the BIA's reasoning, this decision is a straightforward application of 20 years of BIA precedent, concluding that, consistent with Fedorenko, that voluntariness is not relevant.
This isn't merely consistency with Fedorenko. In this case, the BIA is saying he cannot say that his conduct, in effect, is different from the conduct in Fedorenko. And what was relevant about the Fedorenko conduct was it did not have to be voluntary conduct. So it is bringing, it seems to me, the reasoning in this case is relying upon a rule that says the voluntary-involuntary distinction is not significant.
Right. That was the construction. I might be missing some of the subtlety of your point, but let me try it this way.
I doubt it, but go ahead.
Let me try it this way. The statutory formulation we're discussing is the concept of assistance in persecution.
Mm-hmm.
Fedorenko, in the context of the Displaced Persons Act, construes that provision to make involuntariness irrelevant as a matter of law.
Right.
Many courts of appeals and the BIA repeatedly over the last 20 years have held that the reasoning of Fedorenko governs not only the Displaced Persons Act, where it is, of course, directly controlling, but subsequent statutes, of which there are no fewer than seven, using essentially the identical formulation of assistance in persecution, Congress carries forward that formulation in a canonical way, mm-hmm. statute after statute. If you look to legislative history, you will see that Congress repeatedly expresses an affirmative intent that all of these persecutor bar provisions be construed in pari materia. And against that backdrop, we have administrative precedent.
But one thing that Congress has not done, and it didn't do it in this act, is to make the express voluntary-involuntary distinction textually that the DPA made in Fedorenko. And it seems to me that the reasoning set out in this case says this is exactly like the Fedorenko situation. That implies that the same rule in Fedorenko should apply. If the same rule applies, presumably it should be on the basis of a statute which is identical on the textual voluntariness point to the statute in Fedorenko. This one is not.
Identical or not textually distinguishable. To the extent
— Well, you don't have the voluntary-involuntary distinction here in textual treatment that you had in the DPA statute in Fedorenko, do you?
Well, you have the same operative language of assist in persecution.
You don't follow that with the section that uses the word voluntary, whereas the bar does not use the word voluntary, right?
Except you do. Throughout the INA are provisions that are expressly keyed to voluntariness. So you have the same contrast can be made with respect to the INA bars as Fedorenko made with respect to the DPA bar.
Can you give me a couple of examples of the voluntariness that creates, in effect, the same distinction
sure.
as under the DPA?
Sure. Let me give you one. The asylum statute, the substantive asylum statute itself in 8 U.S.C. 1158,
Was that passed as part of the same legislation that created the bar section we're dealing with?
Yes and no. Let me explain. The section 1158, the substantive asylum law, did not have a persecutor bar as originally enacted by the Refugee Act of 1980. The persecutor bar in the substantive asylum statute was added in 1996 by the IRIRA statute, which in the same section, has a provision that asylum can be terminated if the alien voluntarily decides to return to his home. So you have a contrast in the same section of the same statute, conduct-based.
But it's I don't want to split hairs here, but I mean the voluntary return behavior is a behavior of the alien in this country with respect to, in effect, an election under existing federal law, whereas the voluntary involuntary distinction in the DPA was a distinction that referred to the alien's conduct overseas at the relevant time.
That's a fair point, Justice Souter, but to the extent part of the reasoning in Fedorenko rests on the Rosello canon with an inference from a contrast, those same contrasts are present here where the point of the example
is
that
you have convinced me there are contrasts, but I am not sure that they are contrasts that raise the implication in a clear way as it was raised in the DPA.
Well,
and I think that's my only disagreement with you at this point.
Can I bring you back to Aristotle?
Absolutely.
Thank you. This is not a criminal statute.
Exactly.
The government is not imposing punishment upon this person
exactly
for some malfeasance.
Rather, it's giving a grant of a great benefit
exactly.
to a class of people. And your position is that it has narrowed that class, perhaps narrowed it more than was necessary, but that the government thought, rather than letting in and giving asylum to the commandant of Treblinka, it would be better to have a provision that simply excludes those who, under coercion or not, persecuted others. Isn't that?
Did
Aristotle say anything about that?
Limiting
the nation's generosity on the basis of a provision that may or may not have anything to do with blame.
I don't know what Aristotle had to say about
immigration. But you do know that Aristotle was not construing this federal statute, don't you?
To get back to the language, what's wrong with saying you have a clause that says otherwise participated, right? So that must mean, I gather, or could mean that assisted does not have as broad a meaning as you suggest. Because otherwise the participated language would be unnecessary and redundant.
I don't think so, Mr. Chief Justice, because the statutory sequence is the word assist goes all the way back to the Displaced Persons Act. In the 1977 when Congress changes assist to assists or otherwise participates in,
right.
The only consequence of that, if any, could be a broadening, not a narrowing.
Well, I'm not sure that's right, because if assisted does not include otherwise participating, and I understood your broad reading of assisted to cover the prison walls
then it does.
Then I would say assisted needs to be interpreted with ordered and incited.
But
and if it is, then otherwise participated should be interpreted along the same lines.
Mr. Chief Justice, the word assist was construed in Fedorenko not to contain an implicit voluntariness exception. Congress adds to that the word participate, which this Court in Yeski construed not to have an implicit involuntariness requirement.
So you think it was a belt and suspenders redundancy?
Either belt and suspenders or broadening the circle in ways that are difficult to describe in the abstract. But participate, this Court has said in Reeves, participate is a term of breadth. So I don't see the argument that by adding an additional term of breadth to the scheme, Congress somehow narrowed what would otherwise apply.
I may have missed it. What was your answer to the prison walls, the guy who builds the prison walls? Is he or is he not participating in the persecution?
My answer is that the analysis of that question does not turn on whether or not he's compelled to build the prison walls. It turns on footnote 34 of Fedorenko, which says that courts will have to draw difficult lines in distinguishing between the kind of aid that constitutes assistance within the meaning of the statute and the kind of aid that does not.
That's very helpful. Can I get from you the answer to the question that I put to Mr. Pincus? Does the government deny even the necessity of knowledge that what you're doing is assisting in the persecution of somebody? You don't even have to know that you're assisting in the persecution?
In this case, Justice Scalia, our position is that knowledge is a sufficient mens rea and is clearly satisfied here, where petitioner, by his own testimony, knew about the mistreatment of prisoners.
What's your answer to the question?
We have taken the position, Justice Stevens, in other cases, that knowledge is not required. It's been rejected by a few courts of appeals. But
good for them. I mean, that is really an extreme position.
It is a broader position, but happily for me, it is not the position before the court today, particularly in light of Fedorenko, Justice Scalia, which puts a gloss on voluntariness.
In terms of the purpose of the statute, what's the difference between intent and knowledge? in terms of the purpose of the statute. Why is intent a different — I mean, lack of intent any different from lack of knowledge? If you read the statute literally.
The question — I'm not sure the distinction
— You say that you're not presented with a case involving lack of knowledge. You are
— Or intent.
Pardon?
Or intent, Justice Stevens. The conduct here is intentional. The question is whether there's a duress exception to it.
You mean was there an intent to persecute or intent to perform certain acts that constitute persecution?
Intent to perform the acts that constitute —
People use that word intent in the course of the human race to encompass the notion of duress. I mean, that's sometimes done, sometimes not. They're part and parcel of the same thing, which is whether you can blame the person for what he did.
They're not the same thing, even in the criminal.
The criminal law, they're not, I agree,
right.
Because that's because we've seen the new need for specificity. But the question I think Justice Stevens had, and certainly I have, is why do you read some aspects of what it takes to hold a person responsible into the statute, but you don't read other aspects of what it takes to hold a person responsible morally into the statute?
We don't read — Our position is it's not fair to incorporate the full common law background criminal concepts, including that of duress. The question, Justice Breyer, whether assistance in persecution contains an implicit duress limitation seems to me very different from the question whether it contains an implied knowledge limitation, and the latter question is not present here with respect to a prison guard who, by his own admission, knew exactly what was going on and deliberately implemented torture by keeping people in the sun, exposed in the sun, to the point of death.
Your concession or statement earlier on that there are going to be situations for judicial line drawing
right.
in this suggests to me that BIA's discretion isn't applicable here under Chevron Step 2, because what you're saying is this is not a situation where the statute never applies. In a situation where you can logically determine, and your answer on the knowledge question is pertinent, you can logically draw a line between what person's doing and persecution. And yet you say courts are going to have to draw lines. So BIA, the board, might get discretion with respect to where that line is drawn and when, but they do not get discretion on the question of does it ever apply. And what your position here is that this never applies whenever there's a but-for logical connection between the action and the persecution.
Mr. Chief Justice, they certainly get discretion in conducting the analysis of what constitutes assistance, but Fedorenko said that inquiry is independent of any question of duress. It said that the inquiry should happen case by case. That's fine. But it gave — the footnote in Fedorenko gave us two clear data points to help frame the analysis. One is the conduct of a woman who does nothing more than cut the hair of people bound for execution. Court says, as a matter of law, that cannot constitute assistance. The other data point is the case of an armed prison guard, who keeps people in a camp, and the court said, of course, that constitutes
assistance. But you would say the woman who cuts the hair does participate in the persecution if there's a guideline that says, look, we're not going to execute anybody unless before their hair is cut, right?
I would not say that. I think Fedorenko
— You would agree that's a case that's not covered by the statute, even though the person is not going to be executed unless the woman does her job?
I think Fedorenko says that the level and degree and character of assistance of the woman simply cutting the hair does not constitute assistance. At the other continuum of conduct, Fedorenko says that the conduct of an armed prison guard does constitute assistance, even if, as in Fedorenko, the guard served under duress. And Justice Stevens, if I could come back to the facts of Fedorenko, the district court in that case found that if Fedorenko did not serve at the prison camp, he would have been executed. That finding was not reversed either by the Fifth Circuit or by this court, which held that duress was not relevant to the inquiry of assistance.
Mr. Katz.
Petitioner
What about the position that the Displaced Persons Act was special to the Holocaust, that we were dealing with people who said we were just following orders and we did not want to grant those people asylum? Now, in this post-World War II effort, we are engaged in an enterprise with other countries in the world, and should we look to see how they are interpreting this notion of duress, coercion? Are they considering it irrelevant? We just look to see if the person, in fact, was providing some material assistance to persecution.
Justice Ginsburg, it's true that the Displaced Persons Act was limited to the Nazi regime, and later statutes, the Refugee Act, generalizes in the sense of eliminating the time and place restrictions on the definition of refugee. On the specific question of the persecutor bar, Congress carries forward the same language with an affirmative indication of intent to preserve the concept. With respect to your point about the Nazis being singularly horrific in human history, think of how that feature plays out under petitioner's theory. Under petitioner's theory, the uniquely horrific nature of the Nazi regime gives rise to a dramatically expanded class of people who can credibly raise a duress defense. Anyone under Adolf Hitler in the organization chart of the Nazi government could credibly say, if I didn't kill Jews, I would be killed myself. The executive permissibly rejected that construction of things in construing the persecutor bar at issue here.
Thank you, Mr. Katsas. Mr. Pincus, you have 4 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Pincus, who has the burden of proof on assuming that there is an exception for coercion?
The applicant would have the applicant, burden of proof.
How do you decide? There's not going to be any evidence on the other side, I assume. The applicant's going to say, I was coerced. And the only basis for rejecting, is it sufficient basis? I don't believe you.
Yes, the credibility determinations are made all the time. And there is some, I mean, here, the applicant.
I mean, they're made all the time, but how are they made? How are they made? I looked into the person's eyes and they look shifty. No, they have to look, they search around for some little contradiction in the testimony. If the IJ has a suspicion that this person who's testifying through an interpreter, what language did the petitioner here speak?
I'm not English.
You don't know?
I don't know, but not English. There was an interpreter at the hearing.
Yeah, and how many interpreters of that language are there in the United States, and what are the quality of the interpreters?
And, Your Honor, and so they have shifty eyes.
But these are poor, these same issues.
I mean, do they typically have views on the underlying persecution issue that's at issue?
Do the interpreters?
Yes. I mean, it's not at all unreasonable if you have a clash between two ethnic groups in a particular country that the interpreters are going to have views one way or another. They're going to come from one of the groups or one or the other.
They may, Your Honor, but that's a problem. We already have a system where we're deciding whether someone was persecuted, and all of these issues arise. We already are looking very specifically at all of the facts. The same factual development will be relevant to the coercion issue. As I said, the applicant will bear the burden of proof. And here, as in other cases, the country reports are often relied on and are revealing as to whether what the situation is, what the specific context is, makes sense. If I could turn to the criminal law question that Justice Scalia asked, I think the criminal law background is very relevant here as well, because the treaty that this statute was enacted to implement our obligations with respect to, referred specifically to crimes. The exclusion that was that's authorized by the treaty says, and I'm quoting from an excerpt on page 11 of our reply brief, has committed a crime against peace, a war crime, or a crime against humanity. That, therefore, it makes very relevant this body of law that's been developed in the criminal
Why
context.
Is that an apt analogy? If we looked at all of the duress cases that have been decided under the criminal law of this country since the beginning, are we going to find cases where someone said, someone claimed that I was told I had to kill 25 people, 100 people. I had to put people out in the sun until they died.
Well,
because if I didn't do that, I was going to be shot. Aren't the situations entirely different?
I think you're combining two questions, Your Honor. One is, should this language be interpreted to have to require uncoerced conduct in order to label someone a persecutor? We think this is very relevant in deciding that question because the underlying treaty that was implemented specifically referred to crimes, and crimes generally have a criminal liability doesn't apply to someone who acts if they're coerced. Whether the precise standards that have been developed in the federal criminal context are control in all situations here. I think that's something that may not be clear. As I suggested, the Attorney General may have some discretion to flesh out, and the Board may, what is coercion in this context. And there is a debate, as I said before, about whether intentional murder, especially the intentional murder of a group of people, is an act for which coercion is ever a coercion defense is ever available. But those are issues that don't take away from the fact that here the government's position is there is coercion is totally irrelevant. If I could just one other issue, the voluntariness provisions in the statute that my colleague raised in response to Justice Souter's question, those provisions were enacted subsequently. The 1980 Refugee Act adopted the language that's at issue here. May I finish my answer? And that —
It's not actually an answer, but go.
Oh, I'm sorry. May I finish my
— You can finish
thought,
your sentence.
My thought. The language at issue here, those came later in the reenactment of that language in another context. Thank you
Thank you,
much.
Counsel. Case is submitted.